wise family doctor suggested that she splash ice water in the child's face when he started to have a tantrum. It worked beautifully. He never had another tantrum. At the ripe age of 15 months, he had learned the technique of repression. He had been programmed to repress anger because it produced very unpleasant consequences, and he would carry that dubious talent with him throughout his life. Now, when confronted with the multitude of frustrating, annoying, sometimes enraging things that happen to people every day, this man automatically internalizes his natural anger. When that anger collects and builds up, he will have TMS or some such physical reaction in response to it. The story illustrates one of the sources of the need to repress: innocent parental influence. This may be the most common reason for learning to repress. In an attempt to make good people of their children, parents may inadvertently induce the conditions for psychological difficulty later in life. When you think about it, there are many reasons why we repress anger, all logical and mostly unconscious. Everyone wants to be liked or loved. No one enjoys disapproval, so we repress unlovable behavior. We would hate to admit it, but unconsciously we fear reprisal. The cultural imperatives of family and society provide strong motivation not to show anger. This becomes deeply embedded, starting as it does in early childhood. We realize, all unconsciously, that anger is often inappropriate, springing from irritants which ought not to make us angry, and so we repress. Instinctively, we feel that anger is demeaning, and perhaps even more powerful, we feel a loss of control when we are angry. That is something the TMS personality finds hard to take. All of this is unconscious, and thus we are unaware of our need to repress the anger. Instead, we may experience a physical symptom, TMS, or something gastrointestinal, for example. We seem to have a built-in mechanism for avoiding what is emotionally unpleasant, which is the reason for repression. But there appears to be an equally strong force in the mind working to bring those feelings to consciousness, and that is the reason for reinforcements, for what psychoanalysts call a defense. For many years, I was under the impression that TMS was a kind of physical expression or discharge of the repressed emotions I've described. I'd been aware since the early 1970s that these common back and neck pain syndromes were due to repressed emotions. 88% of a large group of patients with TMS had a history of other tension-related disorders like stomach ulcers, colitis, tension headache, and migraine headache. But the idea of TMS as a physical manifestation of nervous tension was somehow unsatisfactory and incomplete. Most important, it did not explain the repeated observation that making a patient aware of the role of the pain as a participant in a psychological process would lead to cessation of pain, to a cure. It was a psychoanalyst colleague, Dr. Stanley Cohen, who suggested in the course of our working together on a medical paper that the role of the pain syndrome was not to express the hidden emotions, but to prevent them from becoming conscious. This, he explained, is what is referred to as a defense. In other words, the pain of TMS, or the discomfort of a peptic ulcer, of colitis, of tension headache, or the terror of an asthmatic attack, is created in order to distract the attention of the sufferer from what is going on in the emotional sphere. It is intended to focus one's attention on the body instead of the mind. It is a response to the need to keep those terrible, antisocial, unkind, childish, angry, selfish feelings from becoming conscious. It follows from this that far from being a physical disorder in the usual sense, TMS is really part of a psychological process. Defenses against repressed emotions work by diverting one's attention to something other than the emotions that are being kept hidden in the unconscious. Patients have different metaphors to describe the process, that the defense acts as a camouflage, that it is a diversion or distraction. To be successful, it must occupy one's attention, and it works even better if you are totally preoccupied or obsessed with whatever it is. That is why physical defenses are so good. They have the ability to really grab one's attention, particularly if they are painful, frightening, and disabling. This is exactly what happens with TMS. It has been a recurrent observation of mine that the more painful the repressed emotion, the more severe the pain of TMS has been. The patient who is found to be harboring enormous anger as a result of childhood abuses, for example, usually has severe disabling pain. The pain disappears only when that person has an opportunity to express the terrible, festering rage that has occupied his or her unconscious for years. Another example of the potential of anger to initiate the pain of TMS. Other physical disorders may serve the same purpose as TMS. A few of the more common ones are gastroesophageal reflux, hiatus hernia, irritable bowel syndrome, hay fever or asthma, tension or migraine headaches, eczema, psoriasis, acne or hives, dizziness, and frequent urination. All of these disorders should be treated by one's regular physician. Though they may be serving a psychological purpose, they must be investigated and treated medically. Hopefully, the patient will also receive some counseling. Each of these physical conditions serves equally to assist repression. The more that practitioners identify them as, quote, purely physical, the more they assist in the defense mechanism, which means the continuation of the pain, the ulcer, headache, or whatever is going on. As long as the defense works, it will continue. Physical, as opposed to psychological defenses against repressed emotions, are undoubtedly the most common because they are so successful. They are also very effective since a patient can transfer from one to another. For example, excellent drugs have been found to reverse the pathology of peptic ulcer. As a result, the mind simply shifts to another physical disorder. One man in his mid-40s told me that 10 years before, he had started to have trouble with his low back. After many years, it was relieved by surgery. A few months after the operation, he began to have stomach ulcer problems, and that went on for almost 2 years. The doctor tried a number of medications, but just couldn't get rid of the ulcer. Finally, it stopped. And shortly thereafter, the patient began to have neck and shoulder pain. It had been going on for almost 2 years, and so he had come to see me. The back surgery and ulcer treatment didn't alleviate his basic problem. They merely acted as placebos and mandated a shift in the location of his physical symptoms. The ulcer story is interesting. There has been a decline in the incidence of peptic ulcer in the United States and Canada over the past 20 to 30 years, due in part to the effective drugs that have been developed. For a better explanation, however, I am indebted to columnist Russell Baker, who in one of his Sunday columns in the New York Times Magazine asked, "Where have all the ulcers gone?" Mr. Baker pointed out that people seem to be getting fewer ulcers. The article set me to speculating that since everyone, doctors and laymen alike, had come to realize that ulcers really meant tension, and since they could be treated successfully with medications, they no longer served the purpose of hiding tension, so fewer people developed them. Could this be the reason why neck, shoulder, and back pains have become so common in recent years? Is it possible that these are now much better hiding places for tension than the stomach? Severity of TMS is measured not only by the intensity of the pain, but by the degree of physical disability that exists. What things is the person afraid of or unable to do? Disability may be more important than pain, because it defines the individual's ability to function personally, professionally, socially, and athletically. In the long run, fear and preoccupation with physical restrictions are more effective as a psychological defense than pain. A severe attack of pain may be over in a few days, but if the person is afraid to do things for fear of inducing another attack, or because he or she has found that the activity will invariably bring on pain, even if it is not an acute attack, then the preoccupation with the body is continuous and the defense is working all the time. In the majority of patients with whom I work, this is the most important factor. Occasionally, I have a patient who says that he or she has no physical restrictions, that pain is the only problem. But such patients are rare. Most patients are afraid of physical activity, which tends to perpetuate the problem by inducing further anxiety and often leads to depression as well. What one sees is truly a physicophobia, a fear of physical activity. The degree of preoccupation with symptoms is a measure of the severity of the problem. Many patients report that the syndrome dominates their lives, while others are clearly obsessed by the disorder. It is the first thing they think of when they awaken in the morning and the last at night before sleep comes. A young woman with whom I was working said one day that she was terrified of the physical pain. It was clear as we talked, however, that she was really terrified about emotional things, and the pain syndrome had allowed her to avoid them. It has been my experience that the overall severity of the pain syndrome, including obsessional components, is a good guide to the importance of the underlying emotional state of the patient. By importance, I mean how much anger there is, and how severe the traumas of early life are that have contributed to that person's current psychological state. People who were abused as children, emotionally or physically, but especially sexually, tend to have enormous reservoirs of rage and shame. This is one of the first things I think of when I see someone who has a particularly severe TMS. The physical symptoms are the means by which they remain out of contact with some terrible, frightening, deeply buried feelings. Those words are not exaggerations. There is great fear and probably enormous rage festering in their minds that they dare not acknowledge. Such patients will tell you that they understand why the pain will not leave. For when they begin to get close to those buried feelings, they are panic-stricken and can proceed no further. They invariably require psychotherapy as part of the therapeutic program. On the other hand, in the great majority of people with TMS, about 85%, the anger level and the reasons for it are much milder, and they experience no emotional reaction when the pain disappears. One has the impression in these cases that the mind has overreacted to the anger, and the defense wasn't necessary in the first place. What has been described is universal in our culture. Only the degree of repressed emotionality varies. And in our culture, nature has created a mechanism whereby we can avoid being aware of those bad feelings. It gives us physical symptoms. Fortunately, there is a way of stopping what is clearly a maladaptive response for most of us. Logic tells us that the brain is reacting in an infantile fashion. However, my work with TMS has demonstrated that the brain has other attributes and can reverse the process that leads to physical symptoms. Fear is pervasive. Anything that heightens anger will increase the severity of symptoms. One of my patients reported that she left the doctor's office in a state of shock, having been told that the lower end of her spine was degenerating. She said she almost fainted in the street, and that her pain was much worse after the visit to the doctor. There are many things about having back pain that stimulate fear. The American public is now convinced that the back is a fragile, delicate structure, easily injured, and perpetually vulnerable. There are dozens of do's and don'ts. Don't bend, don't lift with a straight back, don't sit on a soft chair or couch, don't swim the crawl or breaststroke, don't wear high heels, don't arch your back, don't sleep on a soft mattress, don't run or pursue vigorous sports, etc. ad nauseam. A large group of my successfully treated patients, many thousands, have demonstrated that these are not valid instructions. All they succeed in doing is help perpetuate the pain syndrome and make life hell. There is fear of recurrent attacks. Anyone who has had a severe back attack cannot help but live in terror of the next one. Ironically, by contributing to a high level of anxiety, this fear almost guarantees that another attack will come sooner or later. Anger is enhanced by the perception that one is an inadequate parent, spouse, sexual partner, worker, homemaker, or whatever else you do in life. You can't go to the movies, theater, concert, or restaurant because you can't sit for long. Your woe is doubled if you are self-employed. The sad reality is that the patient with back pain is a prisoner of pervasive fear. And fear is a prime perpetuator of the pain syndrome. It is at this point that the patient will say, "All right, you've convinced me. I understand why I've got this pain. Now how in the world do I change my personality, solve my problems, especially the insoluble ones, like my 90-year-old mother? How do I stop generating anger and anxiety and stop repressing my feelings?" In fact, Mother Nature has been extremely kind in this instance, for the solution doesn't require any of those difficult transformations in the majority of cases. To be sure, a small number of patients will have to be in psychotherapy to recover, but they represent only 10 to 15% of the total. The rest will get better simply by learning all about TMS and changing their perceptions about their backs. Does it sound simple? It is, and it isn't. The word physiology refers to the way the various systems and organs of the body work. All biological systems are extremely complicated, and the higher the animal on the evolutionary scale, the more complicated the physiology. This is particularly true with TMS, because this disorder is the result of an interaction between the mental-emotional and the physical spheres of human biology. Medical science has learned an enormous amount about the physiology of most biological systems in the last 100 years, and about the chemistry and physics of the human body. But virtually nothing is known about interactions between the mind and body, which may be of critical importance in understanding states of both health and disease. TMS appears to be a classic example of mind-body interaction, but we do not understand the chemistry, physics, or cell biology of how emotions can stimulate physical reactions, and yet they do. Here is my concept of how it works in TMS. The physiology of TMS begins in the brain. Here, repressed emotions like anger and guilt set in motion a process in which the autonomic nervous system causes a reduction in blood flow to certain muscles, nerves, tendons, or ligaments, resulting in pain and other kinds of dysfunction in these tissues. The autonomic nervous system is a subsystem of the brain that has the responsibility for controlling all of the body's involuntary functions. It determines how fast the heart beats, how much acid is secreted into the stomach for digestive purposes, how rapidly one breathes, and a host of other moment-to-moment physiologic processes that keep our bodies functioning optimally under everyday circumstances or in emergencies. The so-called fight-or-flight reaction that all animals share particularly important in lower animals, is directed by the autonomic system. In order to meet the emergency, every organ and system in the body is properly prepared. For some systems, it means total cessation of activity so that the body's resources can be mobilized to deal with the danger more effectively. Typically, most of the body's nutritive and excretory activities are shut down. The heart beats more rapidly, and blood is shunted away from less important functions so as to be available in larger quantities for systems that are crucial to escape or fight, such as the muscles. The autonomic system controls the circulation of blood and does it with the most exquisite precision. It can increase or decrease the flow of blood wherever it chooses, and usually does so for good reasons. But what the system does in TMS, we have characterized as an abnormal autonomic activity. It has no useful purpose in the usual sense. It is not contributing to normal daily function or preparing the body for fight or flight. However, it is responding to a psychological need. But we consider what happens to be aberrant, because it results in pain and other distressing symptoms. We have postulated that in TMS, the autonomic system selectively decreases blood flow to certain muscles, nerves, tendons, and ligaments in response to the presence of repressed emotions like anxiety and anger. This state is known as ischemia. That is, the tissue involved is getting less than its normal complement of blood. This means that there will be less oxygen available to those tissues than they are accustomed to, and the result will be symptoms, pain, for example, numbness, tingling, and sometimes weakness. These things happen because of the critical importance of oxygen in all physiologic processes. When it is reduced below its normal levels, one can expect a reaction that will signal that fact. What is difficult to understand is why the autonomic system should react so as to cause pain and other unpleasant symptoms when its normal function is to keep the body operating at an optimal level, regardless of what's going on around it. This is clearly highly unusual, but suggests that there must be some pressing need for the reaction. As I suggested earlier, that need is to deflect the person's attention away from those very unpleasant, often painful emotions that the mind is trying to keep repressed. It is as though the mind has decided that a physical pain is preferable to an emotional one. When viewed in this light, the process is not so illogical. How does one know that oxygen deprivation is responsible for the pain? First, many of the body's reactions to tension and anxiety are the result of abnormal autonomic reactions. The best known is peptic ulcer, but so are spastic colitis, tension headache, migraine headache, and a host of others. Therefore, it was thought logical that the pathological physiology of TMS might also originate in the autonomic system. If the autonomics were to be involved in TMS, the best way that they could produce mischief in muscles and nerves would be through the circulatory system. The small blood vessels bringing blood to these tissues need only be constricted a bit. Less blood would reach the area, the tissues would be mildly oxygen deprived, and pain would result. There is clinical evidence that the physiologic alteration in TMS is oxygen deprivation. It has long been recognized that heat introduced into muscle by diathermy or ultrasound machines will relieve back pain temporarily. So will deep massage and active exercise of the muscles involved. All three of these physical measures are known to increase blood flow through muscle. Increased blood flow means more oxygen, and if that relieves pain, it is logical to assume that oxygen deprivation was responsible for the pain. There is also laboratory evidence for this concept. In 1973, two German research workers reported finding microscopic changes in the nuclei of biopsied muscles from back pain patients. suggesting oxygen deprivation. For additional evidence on the critical role of oxygen in TMS, we are indebted to a group of research workers who have demonstrated in their laboratories in recent years that muscle oxygenation is low in patients suffering from a disorder known as primary fibromyalgia. A group of Scandinavian researchers were able to measure muscle oxygen content with great accuracy and found that it was low in the painful muscles of patients with fibromyalgia. What this means for the etiology or cause of TMS, as I have long maintained, is that fibromyalgia, also known as fibrositis and myofibrositis, and to some as myofasciitis and myofascial pain, is synonymous with TMS. I have treated a large number of patients who came with a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. Their medical histories and physical examinations were consistent with severe TMS. As proof that the diagnosis was correct, they recovered completely. Therefore, it is reasonable to maintain that the finding of mild oxygen deprivation in the muscles of patients with fibromyalgia supports the hypothesis that the cause of pain in TMS is the same: oxygen debt. As I mentioned earlier, TMS manifests itself in many ways, both qualitatively and quantitatively. And it is clear that what is called fibromyalgia is one of the ways in which TMS occurs. These patients are among those who suffer the most severe conditions, for they tend to have pain in many different muscles and to suffer from insomnia, anxiety, and depression, as well as generalized fatigue. All these manifestations are interpreted as evidence of a higher level of repressed emotionality, primarily anger, and therefore more severe symptoms. Most contemporary medical investigators cannot accept such an explanation, since it violates their basic presumption that the etiologic explanation for physical abnormalities must be in the body itself. They cannot conceive of the idea that something like back pain might originate in the brain. And therein lies a great tragedy for the patient. For as long as this conceptual recalcitrance persists, the patient will continue to be misdiagnosed. Oxygen-deprived muscles are painful for two reasons that are known, and perhaps others that are beyond our ability to comprehend. Muscle spasm is the first and most dramatic. It is responsible for the excruciating pain that people experience when they are having an acute attack. However, once the attack has passed, the muscle is not in spasm. In the thousands of patients I have examined through the years, I have rarely found the involved muscles to be in spasm. The second reason is that the chemistry of the muscles may be altered. At the moment, we do not know what these alterations are, but they are painful. It is of great interest that both muscle spasm and these chemical changes can be observed in long-distance runners whose muscles suffer from oxygen deprivation. The presence of muscle pain, either felt spontaneously or induced by the pressure of an examiner's hand, means that the muscle is mildly oxygen-deprived. It does not mean that the muscle is, quote, tense. It needs to be emphasized that this oxygen deprivation is usually low level and does not, therefore, damage tissue. This is particularly true of muscle. The term trigger points, which has been around for many years, refers to the pain elicited when pressure is applied over various muscles in the neck, shoulders, back, and buttocks. There is some controversy over what precisely is painful, but most would agree that it is something in the muscle. Rheumatologists, who have taken the lead in studying fibromyalgia, appear to avoid using the term, probably because of its association with other diagnoses through the years. I neither use it nor avoid it, for I have concluded that these points of tenderness are merely the central zones of oxygen deprivation. Further, There is evidence that some of these points of tenderness may persist for life in TMS-susceptible people, though there may be no pain. Earlier I made the point that most patients with TMS will have tenderness at six key points. The outer aspect of both buttocks, both sides of the small of the back, or lumbar area, and the top of both shoulders. These tender points, trigger points, call them what you will, are the hallmark findings in TMS. They are the ones that tend to persist after the pain is gone. It is an important part of the physiology of TMS to know that the brain has chosen to implicate these muscles in creating the syndrome we know as TMS. Patients sometimes ask if breathing pure oxygen will relieve the pain. This has been tried and unfortunately does not help. If the brain intends to create a state of oxygen deprivation, it will do so, regardless of how oxygen-rich the blood is. Nerve tissue is more sensitive and delicate than muscle. It is likely that oxygen debt causes nerve pain, because the reduced level of oxygen threatens the integrity of the nerve, as it does not in muscle. In other words, muscle can withstand a lot of oxygen debt before it will be damaged, far beyond that which occurs in TMS. More sensitive nerve tissue, however, is more easily damaged, and in order to warn the brain that something is wrong, pain begins with very mild oxygen deprivation. We postulate, then, that nerve pain in TMS is a warning signal. Other nerve symptoms are common in TMS. The person may experience feelings of numbness, tingling, pins and needles, burning, pressure, and other even less common symptoms. These sensations and the pain are felt in that part of the body served by the nerve. There is much about TMS that is mysterious, and one of the most difficult aspects of the syndrome to understand is the apparent involvement of tendons and ligaments. Tendinitis of the elbow, shoulder, or knee, for example, will often disappear in the course of treatment for TMS. It must be assumed, therefore, that these are part of the syndrome. If that is so, what is the physiologic alteration responsible for the pain? It has been generally assumed that tendinitis is the result of inflammation, but there is no evidence at all that this is so. Because it is part of TMS, one is tempted to think that oxygen deprivation is at work. Though tendons have no blood vessels, they are living tissue, and therefore must be supplied with nutrients and oxygen. It is reasonable to assume that the lack of oxygen is also responsible for tendon and ligament pain. Whatever the mechanism, it is clear that these structures are also involved in the charade mounted by the brain in the service of avoiding anxiety and anger. It is very important to know that tendinitis is one more part of the tension myositis syndrome. Let's review the physiology of TMS. It begins with certain emotional states that set in motion activity within the central nervous system, specifically the autonomic system. This results in local vasoconstriction and mild oxygen deprivation of certain muscles, nerves, tendons, and ligaments. This oxygen lack is responsible for the pain that is the primary manifestation of TMS, and the possibility of sensory abnormalities, numbness, pins and needles, and motor deficits such as weakness or tendon reflex changes. Why the mind has chosen to implicate these muscles, nerves, tendons, and ligaments in TMS seems beyond our capacity to comprehend at this time. Indeed, it is likely that at this point in the evolution of the human mind, we are incapable of understanding how the brain works generally, how it comprehends and produces language, how it thinks and remembers, and so forth. Understanding the mechanism of TMS is just one more of the many imponderables of human brain function. Though it may be of academic interest, knowing the physiology of TMS with certainty is not essential. We know how to stop the disorder, how to, quote, cure it, for we know its real cause. The chemical and physical changes that take place in the muscles, nerves, tendons, and ligaments that result in pain and other symptoms are the consequences of a process initiated in the brain for psychological reasons. Since any alteration of normal physiology resulting in physical symptoms would serve the same purpose, it is not important to know with precision what is going on in these tissues. As we shall demonstrate in the treatment of TMS, focusing on the physiology and symptomatology of TMS is actually counterproductive, tending to perpetuate rather than alleviate the problem. Though I find the chore distasteful, it is essential to review the large number of disorders to which neck, shoulder, back, and limb pain are routinely attributed. The listener should know what these diagnoses mean to the people who make them, to the many disciplines that treat them, and to the people who are diagnosed as having them. In the course of my lectures to patients with TMS, it is made clear that it is important to know what is causing the pain and what is not causing it, because many of the diagnoses to be described evoke great fear, and fear is a dominant factor in worsening and perpetuating the pain syndrome. In my experience, structural abnormalities of the spine rarely cause back pain. That shouldn't surprise us, for this epidemic of back pain is very new. Somehow, the human race managed to get through the first 500,000 years or so of its evolution without a problem. But if the structural diagnoses are correct, something happened to the spine during the last evolutionary eye blink, and it has begun to fall apart. This idea is untenable. One suspects that these spine abnormalities have always been there, but were never blamed for pain because there was no pain to blame them for. 50 years ago, back pain was not very common, but more importantly, nobody took it seriously. The epidemic of back pain is due to the enormous increase in the incidence of TMS during the past 30 years. Ironically, the failure of medicine to recognize and diagnose it has been a major factor in that increase. Instead of TMS, the pain has been attributed primarily to a variety of structural defects of the spine. It's essential to know that almost all of the structural abnormalities of the spine are harmless. With that in mind, let's take a look at the common conventional diagnoses. Though the back sufferer isn't aware of it, it is generally known by students of the spine that the last intervertebral disc, between the fifth lumbar vertebra and the sacrum, is more or less degenerated in most people by the age of 20. Discs are structures located between the bodies of spinal bones to take up the shock. They are firmly attached to the vertebral bodies above and below, and in no way can they slip. Enclosed by a tough, fibrous outer shell, there is a thick fluid inside, which is what absorbs the shock. The discs at the lower end of the spine and in the neck, because of all the activity in those locations, begin to wear out at an early age. As I mentioned, some by the age of 20. Although no one knows exactly what happens, the disc gets flatter, suggesting that the fluid inside has dried up or broken through a weakened part of the disc wall, usually toward the back. This breaking through the disc wall is what is known as a disc rupture, or more commonly, a herniation. It is probably similar to squeezing toothpaste from a tube. In some cases, the fluid does not break through, but merely bulges the wall. The important question is, what harm is done by this extruded disc material, if any? The conventional idea is that the toothpaste compresses a nearby spinal nerve, thereby producing pain. If it is the disc between lumbar vertebral L4 and L5, or L5 and the sacrum, the pain will be in the leg. If in the neck, there is arm pain. The leg pain is usually called sciatica. It has been my experience that herniated disc material is rarely responsible for pain or any other neurological symptom. This is a minority opinion, but I am not totally alone. A well-known neurosurgeon and chairman of his department at the University of Miami School of Medicine, Dr. Hubert Rosimoff, has come to a similar conclusion. He did back surgery for many years and apparently bases his conclusion on observed inconsistencies and the logical fact of neurological pathophysiology that continued compression of a nerve will cause it to stop transmitting pain messages after a short time. The result is numbness. How could the herniation then cause continuing pain? Another highly respected physician and investigator who studied the problem for years, Dr. Alf Nakumsen of Sweden, concluded that the cause of back pain was unknown in the majority of cases, and almost all should be treated non-surgically. My conclusion that most disc herniations are harmless is based on 27 years of treating such patients with a high degree of success, leading to the impression that the extruded material is not hurting anything. It's just there. In recent years, there have been numerous reports in the medical literature of herniated discs in patients with no history of back pain. They were discovered inadvertently on CT or MRI studies done to investigate other parts of the body. In order to document the large number of herniated disc patients that I have treated successfully over many years, a follow-up survey was conducted in 1987. 109 patients were interviewed by telephone by a research assistant. Their names were selected randomly from a large population of patients who were seen and treated from 1 to 3 years previously. In each case, pain was attributed to a herniated disc that could be seen on a CT scan. Based on history and physical examination, the diagnosis was TMS. All went through the usual treatment program. Of the 109 patients, 96, that is 88%, were free or nearly free of pain and were able to perform unrestricted physical activity. 11 patients, that is 10%, were improved, experienced some pain, and were able to perform restricted activity. Only 2 patients, 2%, were unchanged. The 2 patients who did not improve were found to have severe, persistent psychological problems and continue in psychotherapy to this day. These statistics make it difficult to take the herniated disc seriously. Yet each of these patients had been told that this was the reason for the pain. 39 of them had been advised to have surgery. 3 had already had such surgery. And most of the rest had been told that surgery might be necessary if conservative measures failed. During the years that I have been engaged in this work, I have seen the diagnosis of spinal stenosis emerge as one of the most common when there is low back pain and no herniated disc to blame. It refers to narrowing of the spinal canal, occasionally thought to be congenital, but most often a result of aging in spinal bones. Build-up of bone, in some places called osteophytes, narrows the canal. My reaction to this abnormality is based on experience with patients. Most of those I have seen, regardless of age, were found to have TMS, which allowed me to disregard the X-ray diagnosis. When stenosis is severe, the canal should be widened surgically, but I have seen very few of such cases. It is my practice, particularly with older patients, to suggest neurological consultation so that the possibility of significant impingement on neural structures can be carefully studied. If the neural picture is satisfactory and the patient has the classic findings of TMS, I proceed with confidence, regardless of what the X-ray shows. After herniated disc, a pinched nerve is one of the most common diagnoses made. Usually when patients present with pain in the neck, shoulder, and upper limb on the same side. What is presumably being pinched is a cervical spinal nerve as it courses its way through a hole formed by contiguous cervical vertebrae, known as a foramen. And what is supposed to be doing the pinching is an osteophyte, a bone spur, or a herniated disc. The diagnosis is fraught with difficulty. It rests on exceedingly shaky concepts. Once more, the need to identify a structural cause is the problem, and sometimes breeds a disturbing lack of objectivity. The following observations throw doubt on the pinched nerve diagnosis. First, these symptoms often occur in young adults who have no bone spurs and no herniated discs. Second, bone spurs are extremely common, and many people who have them don't have pain. Spurs increase in number and size with advancing age, so that by late middle age and beyond, everyone ought to have neck and arm pain from them, but everyone doesn't. Third, neuroradiologists tell us the spurs would have to obliterate the foramen before compression of the nerve would occur, something one rarely sees. Fourth, the same principle applies here as with a lumbar herniated disc. Persistent compression of a nerve will produce objective numbness or absence of pain on testing. This is different from the subjective sensation of numbness that patients sometimes feel in a leg or arm. Fifth, there are numerous reports in the medical literature of large growths in the spine, like benign tumors, that often produce no pain. Most pinched nerve patients have TMS involving the muscles of the neck and shoulders, particularly the upper trapezius muscle and the cervical spinal nerves, after they have left the spinal bones. Four cervical and the first thoracic spinal nerves form what is known as the brachial plexus, a kind of staging area, where they are then reorganized into the nerves that go into the arm and hand. It is highly likely that the brachial plexus is often implicated in the TMS process. But whether it is the spinal nerves, the brachial plexus, or both is irrelevant, for we do not treat the disorder locally. We work on it where it begins, in the brain. Here is a striking case history that teaches many lessons. The patient was a middle-aged professional woman who developed pain in the left neck, shoulder, and entire left arm, with particularly severe pain in the wrist. She was often awakened at night by the wrist pain. To make matters worse, she realized one day that she had lost almost all movement at the left shoulder, what's known as a frozen shoulder. This is a common complication of shoulder pain. Patients apparently begin to limit movement at the shoulder, probably because of pain, without realizing that they're not moving it, and are suddenly aware that the range of motion is gone. In the absence of normal movement, the capsule of the shoulder joint shrinks, as it will in any joint in which there is restricted movement. Further, she reported that the left hand was weak, and she tended to drop things. Despite the ominous sound of these symptoms, I suspected she had TMS, and the physical examination supported the diagnosis. The patient was receptive to the diagnosis. She was familiar with the syndrome and fit the psychological profile perfectly. She was overcommitted professionally, extremely hardworking and compulsive about her responsibilities. To my embarrassment, the symptoms did not respond to the usual therapeutic program. On the contrary, they continued to be severe for many weeks. Thinking there might be something serious going on that was mimicking TMS, I arranged for a neurologic consultation. The physical examination and all tests were normal. After many weeks, the symptoms began to subside, and as they did, we both realized why they had started in the first place and why she was now getting better. The trouble began when she was informed that she was going to lose a very important member of her research team. In anticipation of that event, an enormous amount of work had to be done, and my patient dreaded the woman's departure. Hence, a great deal of anxiety and undoubtedly a lot of deep-down anger at this unfortunate turn of events was generated. The unconscious mind is not particularly logical about such things. Total disappearance of symptoms coincided with the actual departure of the valued colleague, suggesting that with a fait accompli, there was no longer any need for the TMS. She regained full range of motion of the shoulder without benefit of physical therapy. This was a classic pinched nerve diagnosis, except that it wasn't. As the case clearly demonstrates, TMS exists in the service of psychological phenomena. To attribute symptoms to a structural abnormality is a sad diagnostic error. Facet is the technical name for a joint between two spinal bones. Like all joints, they are subject to wear and tear and begin to look abnormal as we get along in years. It is believed that these changes cause pain in some patients. In my experience, they do not. What is generally meant when the term arthritis of the spine is used is osteoarthritis or osteoarthrosis. These refer to the normal aging changes we've been talking about. They are also referred to as spondylosis. I have not found that this is pathological, therefore not productive of symptoms. Rheumatoid arthritis is an entirely different matter. It is an inflammatory process which can strike at any joint in the body and is always painful. Transitional vertebra is a congenital abnormality in which there is an extra bone at the lower end of the spine, usually attached to the pelvic bone. It often gets the blame when found in the presence of back pain. Spondylolysis is another defect in a vertebral bone, easily detected on X-ray and rarely responsible for back pain in my experience. Spina bifida occulta is still another congenital abnormality at the end of the spine, but in this one, there is a piece of bone missing. Once more, pain is historically but mistakenly attributed to this defect. Spondylolisthesis is an abnormality in which two vertebral bones, usually at the lower end of the spine, are not correctly aligned with each other. It is a scary-looking thing on X-ray, but I have found it to be uniformly benign. It would be imprecise to say that spondylolisthesis never causes back pain, but thus far, I have not seen a patient in whom it did. Between 1976 and 1980, two Israeli physicians reported the results of studies they had done to determine whether certain spinal abnormalities caused back pain. Their method was to compare the X-rays of people with and without a history of back pain. If people with back pain had these abnormalities more commonly, one could presume that the abnormalities might be the cause of the pain. They found no statistical difference in the incidence of degenerative osteoarthritis, transitional vertebra, spina bifida occulta, and spondylolysis between the two groups. There was a small statistical difference for spondylolisthesis. In other words, one could not attribute back pain to these disorders, with the possible exception of spondylolisthesis. Scoliosis refers to an abnormal curvature of the spine commonly seen in teenage girls and usually persisting into adult life. Its cause is unknown. It rarely causes pain in teenagers, but is often blamed for back pain in adults. I have not yet found this to be the case. The following case history is typical. The patient was a woman in her 30s who had suffered recurrent attacks of back pain since her teens. Several years before I saw her, she had experienced a severe attack at a time when she was taking care of her young children. Mild scoliosis, to which the pain was attributed, was seen on X-rays. She was told her back pain would gradually worsen as she got older. Despite this dire prediction, she recovered from that episode and did fairly well until 2 months before I saw her, when she had a bad attack. She said it began when she was bending over and, quote, felt something snap. She was further frightened because her trunk was tilted to one side. On taking her history, I learned that over the years she had experienced a number of episodes of tendonitis in the arms and legs, occasional pain in the neck and shoulders, stomach and colon symptoms, hay fever, and severe headaches. A classic TMS patient. The physical examination was normal, except for the usual tenderness on palpation of muscles in the neck, shoulders, back, and buttocks. She had no trouble accepting the diagnosis, participated in the treatment program, and was soon pain-free. She later reported that there had been no more attacks, that she sometimes had mild pain, but knew it was harmless and went about her life without fear. It is clear that scoliosis was not the source of her pain, since nothing in the treatment changed the scoliosis. It is equally clear that her personality predisposed her to a variety of benign physical ailments, including TMS. Osteoarthritis of the hip is well known among laymen because it is common and because of the dramatic surgical procedure in which the entire hip joint is replaced. The patient gets a new socket and a new ball, the head of the femur, to fit into it. This is certainly one of the great triumphs of reconstructive surgery. What necessitates this operation is the overgrowth of bone and the wearing away of the cartilage of the joint, so that it loses range of motion and becomes dysfunctional. It is also alleged that these osteoarthritic joints are painful, and that may be so in some cases. One must, however, be very careful, for I have seen a number of patients whose, quote, hip pain was clearly due to a manifestation of TMS. Just recently I saw such a case. The patient was a woman in her 60s who complained of hip pain. X-ray of the hip joint showed only moderate osteoarthritic change, to which the pain had been nevertheless attributed. But the physical examination told the tale. She had perfectly normal range of motion in the joint, and there was no pain with weight bearing on that leg. The site of the pain was located about 2 inches above the joint and could be reproduced by direct pressure. What she had was tendinalgia due to TMS. Frequently, the pain will come from buttock muscle or the sciatic nerve involved with TMS. I can say this with some confidence because I treat these people and their pain goes away. I do not say that this is invariable, but merely that one must be alert to the possibility that hip pain is not always due to a degenerated hip joint. Chondromalacia is a roughening of the underside of the patella, or kneecap, which is no doubt the reason why it is routinely blamed for knee pain. Unlike what has just been said about hip osteoarthritis, this is a disorder that never, in my experience, causes pain. Invariably, the examination discloses evidence of TMS tendinalgia of one or more of the many tendons and ligaments that surround the knee. The pain in these cases is not knee pain, strictly speaking, for it is from outside the joint. Bone spurs are often demonstrated by X-ray and universally blamed for pain in the heel. In my experience, the spur is not symptomatic, and the pain is usually due to TMS tendinalgia. Muscular rheumatism, chronic aches and pains, disturbed sleep, and morning stiffness affect a few million people in the United States, most of them women between the ages of 20 and 50, and may be diagnosed as fibromyalgia. Though the diagnosis of fibromyalgia is being made with increasing frequency, the cause of the disorder is still said to be unknown, and the patient is told that he or she must learn to live with the pain. For many years, it has been clear to me that this disorder is one of the many variants of TMS. The manifestations tend to be severe and are often accompanied by anxiety or depression. But, as I have said so many times in this program, many doctors have a visceral inability to accept such a concept. Psychogenic is a dirty word. It's what you call something if you can't figure out what it is. They cannot conceive of the possibility that emotions can cause bodily changes. Doctors generally say they are not sure what causes fibromyalgia, but a laboratory abnormality has been identified in this disorder. It is oxygen deprivation. The trouble is that having identified a physiologic alteration, the doctors don't know what to do with the information, though they try mightily to explain it on physical and chemical grounds. Fibromyalgia is TMS. I have seen and treated hundreds of people with these symptoms over the years. As I've stated, they suffer more severely than the average patient with TMS, and often require psychotherapy. A bursa is a structure designed to protect underlying bone in a place where there is a lot of pressure. There are two locations where pain is often attributed to an inflammation in the bursa, the shoulder and the hip. Medically, these are known as subacromial bursitis and trochanteric bursitis. The shoulder is a complicated joint where there are many things that may go wrong and cause pain. What I find most frequently is that the painful structure is a tendon passing above the bursa at or near the point of the tendon's attachment to the bone. Hence, the cause of the pain is a tendinalgia, not bursitis. And like most tendinalgias, is due to TMS. Thus, both the anatomy and pathophysiology are wrong in many cases of TMS when the pain is attributed to subacromial bursitis. Shoulder pain is also commonly attributed to a rotator cuff tear. It is understandable when this happens to a professional athlete, but such abnormalities are often the result of the wear and tear of aging and are not painful. Similarly, pain around what one might call the point of the hip, the trochanter, is usually ascribed to bursitis, but in my experience is again a tendinalgia of TMS origin. In the group of disorders referred to as tendinitis, the tendon is correctly identified as the offending part, but the reason given for the pain is incorrect. The anatomy is right, but the diagnosis is wrong. It is generally assumed that the painful tendon is inflamed because of overuse, so the treatment is to immobilize and rest the part and/or inject the tendon with a steroid, cortisone. Relief is often only temporary. Many years ago, the suspicion dawned on me that tendinitis, more properly called tendinalgia, might be part of TMS when a patient reported that not only had his back pain resolved with treatment, but his elbow had ceased to hurt. I put this to the test and indeed found that I could get resolution of most tendinalgias. I now consider tendon / ligament to be the third type of tissue involved in TMS. Common sites of tendinalgia are the shoulder, elbow, wrist, hip, knee, ankle, and foot. Coccidinia refers to pain deep in the midline crease between the buttocks. It is generally assumed that the tail end of the bone, the coccyx, is the source of pain, though it is quite clear that often the area involved is the lower end of the sacrum. Whether it is coccyx or sacrum, the symptom is usually a mystery to the diagnostician since nothing is seen on X-ray. Commonly, patients will relate it to a hard fall, usually in the distant past. Coccidinia is a frequent manifestation of TMS and is probably a tendinalgia since muscles attach to the sacrum and coccyx all along their length. Proof? It disappears with the talking treatment. Another TMS tendinalgia attributed to something else is found in the forepart of the bottom of the foot. Pain is usually in the metatarsal region and is almost always blamed on a neuroma, which is a benign tumor. The pain goes with TMS treatment. The pain in plantar fasciitis is located on the bottom of the foot along the length of the arch. Although they are often vague about cause, doctors may ascribe this pain to inflammation. The area is usually very tender to palpation and seems quite clearly to be a manifestation of TMS. Mononeuritis multiplex is another descriptive diagnosis, but the cause is frequently unknown. It refers to nerve symptoms that appear to affect many nerves in a random pattern. It can occur with diabetes, but many people who have it are not diabetic. In my view, it is often an example of TMS neuralgia. Because TMS tends to involve so many different muscles and nerves in the neck, shoulders, and back. Temporomandibular disorder, or TMD, is a very common painful condition of the face that has historically been attributed to pathology of the jaw joint, or TM joint, and therefore has been in the dental domain. I have never treated this disorder specifically, but I'm strongly inclined to think that it is similar in cause to tension headache and TMS. TMS patients who come in for neck and shoulder pain frequently give a history of TMD, and the jaw muscle is tender to palpation, just like the shoulder, back, and buttock muscles. Inflammation must be discussed, for it is the explanation presented for many cases of upper and lower back pain, and is the basis for the prescription of both steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, such as cortisone, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, such as ibuprofen. Because of the magnitude of the back pain problem, these medications are widely used. Experience with the diagnosis and treatment of TMS makes it clear that the source of the pain is often neither spinal structures nor inflammation. An inflammatory process is an automatic reaction to disease or injury. It is basically a protective healing process. The response to an invading bacteria or virus is an inflammation. If that's what an inflammatory process is, what is going on in the back? Is it an infection, a response to a back injury, or what? No satisfactory, scientifically supported answer has ever been given. I have suggested in this audio program that the source of the pain is mild oxygen deprivation and not inflammation. This idea has at least a modicum of support from the rheumatologic studies on fibromyalgia. The term sprain should be restricted to clear-cut instances of minor injury like turning the ankle. I am not sure what a strain is supposed to be. Unfortunately, both of these terms are often used when the symptom is a TMS manifestation. Having briefly reviewed these common traditional diagnoses for the varieties of pain we have discussed, let us now look at the conventional treatments employed. I once wrote that therapeutic eclecticism is a sign of diagnostic incompetence. The fact that there are so many different treatments for the common neck, shoulder, and back pain syndromes suggests that the diagnosticians are not really sure what the problem is. Of course, the patient is always given a diagnosis, usually a structural one. But subsequent management, including the use of medications, physical therapies of different kinds, manipulation, traction, acupuncture, biofeedback, transcutaneous nerve stimulation, and surgery, many of which are symptomatic treatments, suggests that the diagnoses are on shaky grounds. People with TMS need to know about these treatments so they can understand why they did or did not respond to them, or why they derived only partial or temporary benefit from them. In thinking about how to review the subject, it occurred to me that the best approach might be to consider each treatment modality from the standpoint of its intended purpose. Of course, all treatments are supposed to relieve pain, but the important question is, how? What is the rationale for each treatment? Before we get into this, let's discuss the subject of the placebo effect, because of its crucial importance in any discussion of treatment. A placebo is any treatment that produces a good therapeutic result despite the fact that it has no intrinsic therapeutic value. A sugar pill is a classic example. It is clear that the desirable outcome must be attributed to the ability of the mind to manipulate the various organs and systems of the body. In order to do this, the mind must believe in the efficacy of the treatment and/or the treater. The key concept here is belief. The patient must have blind faith. But if he or she does, the result can be impressive. Consider the following story, which was first reported by Dr. Bruno Klopfer in 1957. It concerns a man with a fulminating cancer of the lymph nodes who convinced his doctor to treat him with a drug called cribiazin. The man had a miraculous recovery with disappearance of his many large tumors. He did well, until he heard news reports of the ineffectiveness of cribiazin, whereupon he regressed to the same desperate state in which he had been before. Impressed with his response to the treatment, the doctor told him he would give him injections of a more powerful cribiazin, but this time used only sterile water. Once more, the patient responded dramatically, and his tumors melted away. When the American Medical Association officially announced the decision that carbiazin was of no value, his tumors returned, and he died soon after. It is clear from this case history that a placebo works on the body, not the imagination. In this instance, it stimulated a vigorous response in the immune system that was able to destroy the tumors. Based on the impression that most of the pain syndromes I see are due to TMS, I have to conclude that beneficial results from most of the treatments to be described are the work of the placebo factor. If the pain in a given case is truly the result of an injury, if some structure has been traumatized, if a period of healing is required, then treatments designed to rest an injured part are logical. They include rest in bed, restrictions on physical activity, the use of cervical collars, lumbar corsets or braces, and the use of lumbar traction, which, as I mentioned, is really designed to keep the patient in bed, since the weights used could not possibly pull the spinal bones apart. The rest in bed is almost universally prescribed for patients thought to be suffering from a herniated disc. If, however, there is no pathological structural abnormality, if the person has TMS, the rationale is gone. Not only are these prescriptions of no value, but they contribute to an intensification of the problem by suggesting to the patient that there is something going on dangerous enough to require complete immobilization. As I emphasized earlier, even the perception of a physical rather than an emotional cause for the pain will perpetuate the symptoms. The collars and corsets used are a bit ridiculous, for they do not immobilize the part corseted. When someone reports feeling better or having become dependent on one of these, I think, placebo. Pain relief is the goal of all treatments. But treatments to relieve pain are designed to take away pain per se. Generally, this is symptomatic treatment, and therefore poor medicine, unless it is administered for humanitarian purposes. The use of morphine, Demerol, or other strong analgesics is certainly justified when there is excruciating pain, but not as a definitive treatment. Acupuncture appears to work as a local anesthetic. In other words, it blocks the transmission of pain nerve impulses to the brain. If one is dealing with a chronic disease for which no relief of pain can be expected, this is a good treatment. For the typical back pain patient, it can give temporary relief, but it does nothing about the underlying process, the cause of the pain. Nerve blocks are widely used, especially when pain is severe and intractable. A local anesthetic is injected and does essentially what acupuncture does. Therefore, the criticism of this as treatment for back pain is the same. Transcutaneous nerve stimulation, or TNS, depends on mild electric shocks administered over the painful area to give pain relief. Electrodes are usually taped in place, and the patient can activate the shock at will. One can say the same thing about this as for the two previous treatments. However, there is a real question whether this functions as anything but a placebo. A group at the Mayo Clinic published a study in 1978 in which they demonstrated that a placebo worked equally well. When there is prolonged relief as a result of any of these treatments, one must suspect a placebo effect. There can be no other explanation, for they do not attack the cause of the problem. To the prescribers of treatments to promote relaxation, I would put the question, to what end? What is your purpose in trying to relax the person? What do you hope to accomplish? There's considerable fuzziness about this subject in the area of pain relief. There is no question that a calm, relaxed person will experience less pain, but again, we are engaged in symptomatic treatment. The basic disorder is not being treated. Yet how much time can be devoted each day to the relaxing exercises? I advise my patients that meditation and relaxation exercises can't hurt, but one cannot depend on them for definitive relief of pain. The specific role of biofeedback in pain relief is to produce muscle relaxation. The usual procedure is to affix small electrodes over forehead muscles, whose electrical activity, which reflects muscular activity, then registers on a gauge or screen. The subject is then instructed to reduce the gauge reading, which means the muscle has relaxed, and this in turn produces reflex relaxation in muscles elsewhere in the body. I do not prescribe biofeedback, as again, it is treating the symptom. Probably the most common treatment among those used to correct a structural abnormality is manipulation. The abnormality for which this is used is malalignment of spinal bones, and the purpose of treatment is to restore alignment. I do not believe the abnormality exists, and if it did, I do not believe it could be changed by manipulation. On occasion, dramatic relief of pain follows a manipulation, suggesting that the person is having a good placebo response. Patients generally return for these treatments regularly. It is likely, therefore, that they are having a placebo response, which is known to be temporary. Though not as common as manipulation, surgery to remove extruded intervertebral disc material is frequently performed. Without question, such procedures are often essential. It is my impression, however, based upon my experience with patients with herniated discs, that the extruded disc material is often not responsible for the pain. Needless to say, the physicians who perform these operations do so with the sincere conviction that an offending substance is being removed. This is the concept that governs the decision to do surgery, and it is widely held. Nevertheless, because of my therapeutic experience, I am forced to the conclusion that surgery may sometimes produce a desirable result because of the placebo effect. The strength of a placebo, meaning its ability to achieve a good and permanent effect, is measured by the impression it makes on the person's mind. This is why surgery is probably a very powerful placebo. Cervical traction, which can actually distract or pull apart the cervical bones to a slight degree, is another attempt to alter a structural abnormality. In this case, to try to make the cervical foramina larger. These are the holes formed by two spinal bones through which the spinal nerves make their way. The idea is to make the holes larger, so the nerves won't supposedly be, quote, pinched. But as I have said before, the idea that they are being pinched is usually fantasy, and once again, there is much ado about nothing. For years, the doctrine of strengthening back and abdominal muscles to protect the back or relieve it of pain has been preached across the length and breadth of the land. It is an idea that is deeply ingrained in the American mind, and it is dead wrong. Programs are taught in the YMCA, exercises prescribed by thousands of doctors, and people are trained by a large variety of therapists. There is nothing wrong with doing these exercises and strengthening these muscles. It's a very good thing. But I tell my patients they will neither make your pain go away nor protect you from it. And if they do, you are having a placebo effect. What about using exercise to get you going, to break your fear of physical activity? That is a very different story and a very good use for exercise. There are a number of physical treatments that will increase the flow of blood into an area by increasing the temperature of the tissue. For example, Heat can be generated within muscle by the use of shortwave or ultrasonic radiation. Deep massage and active exercise will do the same thing. Contrary to what